365 days a year.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay, your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people in Santa Barbara, at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets, and at Montecito's Upper Village. At Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Neil, it's like Groundhog Day. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm glad that the Electoral College vote looks like it's wrapped up, because I didn't want the competition, because I'm sure everyone around is watching the count on CNN.
I thought we're all faithless voters voting for Neil Kreisel.
Well, in this case, I'd rather not. I'd rather them vote for who they're supposed to vote for. But it looks like it's pretty well locked in. So it's another sigh of relief.
Good, good. Glad to hear it. Us working folk, I haven't been glued to my TV. You know how it goes. So we are thrilled today to have a guest. We have David Seacrest, who's the owner of the law offices of David S. Seacrest. So Dave, good to see you, and thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So the first article today is a follow-up of last week's article by Jason Swegg in the Wall Street Journal. And if you recall, last week his article was how he had signed up for Robin Hood investing, and how he was following all of the craziness that everyone who is a member does, and how he lost money. And this article goes into the whole Robin Hood issue a little bit more in detail. And it talks about two things that they do that nobody else in the traditional marketplace does. There's such a thing as a leveraged ETF, which basically is a supercharged fund that borrows money and therefore increases the leverage or the amount of risk you take, and correspondingly gives you a much greater opportunity to have a higher return. Now, in order to buy a leveraged ETF on Fidelity or any of the major traditional brokerage sites, you need to sign a waiver that you understand the risks and that you're a qualified investor. Not only does Robinhood not do that, but they just give you the positive aspect of investing in this. They continue to give you updates if you buy one about opportunities in others without any kind of hedge clause. And in terms of options, which I think is even more outrageous, they only give you, when you take a look at options, the possible upside, but they don't give you the downside. And as you know, the downside on an option is 100% loss if it doesn't work out. So what he's saying is, not only is there this sort of euphoria that he talked about last week where you end up not investing but having fun gambling, there are a couple of intrinsic things that they do that make it even riskier.
Yeah, you know, it's somewhat remarkable to me, as the SEC continually comes down with new regulations regulating the brokerage industry in general, and advisors and behaviors and disclosures, that it's going to, I feel like the Robinhood investors will eventually catch up and the regulation will catch up with them. But the question will be, how many people need to be hurt before that happens?
Yeah, and right now you don't have many victims. You have a lot of winners, so there's no one.
Exactly. In up markets, it covers a lot of sins. It's the down markets that things really, really come to fruition.
The next article is from the New York Times, and it entitled "Pandemic Squeezes Pension Managers." And, you know, we could get rid of the word pandemic and squeeze pension managers. And we've talked about it over the years, that the assumptions that pension fund managers use is their goal based upon the actuarial needs for their clients to be able to fully fund the pension liabilities continues to get squeezed. And the article basically talks about lowering average return expectations. And at the same time, many, including CalPERS pension funds, are reducing the expected returns from the funds, which has to be made up somewhere. And where it's made up is from the employees and the pension funds. The corporate pension funds now have to put more earnings in, or employees are going to be put into a position where they have to put more of their salary in. So this is something that has, you know, continued. And it's interesting, you would think with the stock market up so much, this wouldn't be a problem. But the problem is that interest rates are so low, and a good deal of pension fund money is invested in bonds, and the interest return has been almost non-existent.
Well, it's interesting. So a local employer here in Santa Barbara who just recently redid their pensions to make it much less favorable for the employees, they're having employees retire. And, you know, when you think about it, the lump sum that they would give you would be basically, let's use an example of $285,000. And of that lump sum, they are willing to give you $2,400 for the rest of your life per month. So when you do the math on that, you know, you're looking at about a 9% return year over year, which many of these pension funds have restrictions as to how much equity to bond ratios that they can go, how risky can they go, basically how much stock can they have. And the only way you're going to get returns of that caliber of about a 9% year over year is to be in 100% stock portfolio. And that is not how the pension fund managers manage. And so I look at that and I say, that's a recipe for this pension fund to not be able to work long-term for their employees.
Yeah, it is. It's been a problem for years, and it's going to continue to be a problem. The next article is entitled Musk, and they're talking about Musk. Elon Musk decries MBAization. And in this article, he's whining about the fact that too many people are getting MBAs, and it hurts their creativity. And we need more people who are entrepreneurs. And, you know, to me, that's sort of very, very short-sighted. There are people that are entrepreneurs, and we need, obviously, them. But we also need people that understand business, understand finance, in order to make sure that the idea of the entrepreneur is solidly managed. And I think this is another example of extremes that, you know, Musk has been lucky enough to be able to succeed with, but it's not a great recipe. And the article, you know, has obviously quotes from all of the leading MBA schools saying how short-sighted that is. And I certainly agree with that.
Well, it kind of goes along the lines of where society is going in recent years, where it's looked down upon to be a graduate from one of the Ivy League universities, that that's an elitist, or that's not something that you strive for. And it's really dangerous in that when you think about where people want to spend their time and how they get to these Ivy League schools, you know, Varsity Blues scandal aside, you know, it usually takes a lot of hard work and a lot of brains and a lot of diligence. And so to make that a negative as opposed to a positive can have real repercussions in our society long term.
And this article from the Washington Post is actually, you know, quite informative. And it is entitled Economics is Going Through an Intellectual Revolution on Public Debt. And it begins with a quote from John Maynard Keynes that says, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And what the article is focused on is the general view for years that when you had large government borrowing, large government debt accumulation, you are going to cause interest rates to rise, and it has this crowding out effect. You're going to crowd out the non-government borrowers, which will hurt business. Well, we have the highest deficits we've ever had, and we don't have inflation. And so there is a need now to take a look at this and say, you know, maybe it's possible, given the change in our economic environment, where you have slack demand and low interest rates because of intervention by central banks, that maybe you can have very low interest rates and therefore have deficits without that inflation impact. And so, you know, it's time for people to kind of reassess that old view that deficits cause interest rates to rise.
Right. And in this zero interest rate environment, it will be difficult to figure that out if rates don't start coming off the zero that they're on right now.
And you know that even though they passed the biggest tax increase ever, and we have the largest deficits ever, that the Republicans didn't seem to care about. With Trump as president, now you're going to see a great deal of pressure on the Democrats not to spend money and, you know, worry. All of a sudden, we're going to have the resurgence of worrying about deficits.
Well, I think deficit hawks back in, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. It just, it is quite hypocritical the way it will come out, for sure.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
And we can be reached at 805-564-1290, or you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. So today we have with us, I almost said Ryan Seacrest, because we were talking about him at the break. But in fact, we have David Seacrest, who is the owner of the law offices of David S. Seacrest here in Santa Barbara. He specializes in employment litigation matters. And we are thrilled to hear from you. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Diane. Hi, Neil. It's a pleasure to be here. Big fan.
So tell us, what drew you to the study of law, and what made you want to become an attorney?
Well, I have an interesting path to the law, which started at the dinner table. My father was a corporate attorney. He went to the University of Michigan Law School right after World War II, after having served in the Pacific. Got his PT boat shot out from under him in Australia. And he would we would have wonderful dinner conversations wherein everybody was expected to, of course, be polite and orderly, but be able to back up what you were saying and argue it in a cogent way. So I learned right off the bat that was gonna be part of my life, because it was very interesting for me to do that. Plus, I grew up I'm now 65. I I think like I'm in the middle of my career right now in law, because it's not that strenuous physically. And I think I'll be doing it for a while. It's a lot of fun. But back when I grew up in the 60s, you know, there were some great legal TV shows on, like The Defenders and Perry Mason, and movies like To Kill a Mockingbird. And I was just drawn to them. So I always knew that I'd probably be a lawyer, not like my dad. He's a corporate lawyer. I wanted to be a litigator because I was a bit of a performer. I was the youngest of five kids. I had to be the loudest all the time to get any attention. So I always knew I'd go to law school, but I wanted to put it off as long as possible because I knew it's a real grind. So after I got out of college in 1978, I took 6 years and just had the greatest time of my life. I look at it as an early installment on my retirement down the road, way down the road.
That's the way to do it. Then yeah, you didn't have the quote what is it, that the youth is wasted on the young or something?
That's exactly right. So I traveled all over the world. I had a lot of crazy jobs. I worked a lot of low-end labor jobs like a dishwasher, bartender. I moved out to California within minutes of graduating from college in Ohio because I always wanted to come out here. Never left. Lived in Pacific Beach and in San Diego. And for 6 years, and then I worked as a flight attendant. I was actually a flight attendant for an airline called PSA. And that's the way I was able to afford and work my way through law school. And I'd be reading my torts and my contracts book at the back of the plane while my colleagues, I persuaded them to shag cups for me. So I knew I'd do that at some point. And after 6 years of fun and games and travel and meeting all kinds of fascinating people, I went to University of San Francisco School of Law for 4 years. I went for 4 years because I took the part-time program because I worked two jobs during during law school. I was a clerk for the United States Attorney. I was also a law clerk for a period of time for a law firm that I ultimately joined. And I also worked as a flight attendant throughout law school. So I was busy. And then I started working for an insurance defense firm, and I was thrown into the pit. I was told to try cases immediately by a very mercurial partner who I reported to, who was a brilliant litigator, but just kind of crazy. And so I, you know, there I was in my first case, and I took 32 depositions. Now, for those of you who know what a deposition, it's a very expensive, time-consuming process. So to take 32 depositions in a single case was unheard of, but for whatever reason, the client trusted me, and we ended up prevailing in my first jury trial about 2 years after the case was filed. And it was an interesting fraud case against a very large manufacturer in Silicon Valley of printed circuit board inspection machines. After about 4, 5, 6 years with this law firm, I decided to go on my own. And since 1996, I had my own sole practice focusing almost exclusively in employment litigation on behalf of employees who have lost their job due to discrimination, disability, age, whatever case would come in the door, I would take it, work it up. And I found it very gratifying, first of all, because I was on my own. And technology has enabled me to, you know, litigate against the largest companies in the country and the largest law firms in the country, because litigation, as Thomas Friedman said, the earth is flat, and all of the technology enables you to, you know, compete. And it's extremely gratifying because it's obviously very challenging. And if you're going against some of these brilliant, very highly paid attorneys, you have to be on your toes. And I've had some success, which I'm grateful, but mostly, you know, I noticed early on in my career when I decided to go down this path, when you meet someone, the first thing you ask them is, what do you do? And it's important to people because their career and their job is kind of, in a lot of ways, who they are, along with family and other very important things in life.
Yeah, it provides purpose.
Yeah, exactly. So when that's taken from them suddenly and perhaps illegally, that's for me to determine in assessing the case, that's a big deal for them. So of all the faces in my mind over the past 30 years of doing this, I see the people that I've helped restore some segment or part of their dignity and self-worth. And it's very gratifying. I can only, since I'm a sole practitioner, I can only take cases that I know I can win. And I have to bet my reputation and my skill and my experience on that because I don't get paid. It's a business when you're a contingency plaintiff's attorney, whether it's personal injury, which I do not do, or employment litigation. to make sure that you win. You got to have a business plan, and it's like a caveman. You got to go out, you got to find the food, you have to kill the food, you have to drag it back, and you have to cook it. And if you don't do that, you don't eat. So it's very stimulating and very challenging. And that's a long story about what drew me to law.
How did you get insurance defense to employment law? What made you choose that segment of the legal field?
Well, I really didn't choose it. They chose me. Offers in the 1980s were not very good. And so I took a job with a medium-sized insurance defense firm, mostly because I wanted to do litigation and they would just throw me into the fire. I was defending cases. I even defended a school district from a claim of improper conduct by one of their teachers in a three-week jury trial in Salinas. So I got my litigation experience doing that. And I would meanwhile try to pull in through the back door all these plaintiffs' employment cases. It just went against the culture of that small law firm. So I decided to branch out on my own and just do strictly employment litigation. And that's what I've done since then. I never looked back.
Now, how is it practicing in a town like Santa Barbara, where a lot of the networking is where you get new clients, but we don't have a lot of large employers here? So there aren't a lot of employees, shall we say, you know, for a lack of, unlike in Los Angeles or San Francisco or some major metropolitan area. So how do you get new clients?
I get almost all my clients from not just my advertising, but from other attorneys and former clients, word of mouth effectively. And I also don't limit my practice to Santa Barbara. I have an active practice throughout the Tri-County area. I go down to Ventura, San Luis Obispo. I also have taken cases since I practiced up in Northern California for about 20 years, all the way up there, the nine counties of the San Francisco Bay Area. I also have many cases in Orange County, San Diego. I try to stay away from LA because it could be years before you get a trial date and even a year or more before you can even have a motion heard in Los Angeles. But I have had a few cases in Los Angeles. I've had some luck. So the greatest compliment that I can receive as a plaintiff's employment attorney is after I've litigated very politely, very professionally, and very amicably with some of the great defense attorneys in this area, in Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, Ventura, wherever, when they call me because their sister or their mom or a friend has lost their job and they think they may have a case. So I get a lot of referrals from attorneys. I get a lot of referrals from people I've litigated against, and that's a great compliment. And I'm gratified to be able to help anybody who calls. And even if, by the way, you don't have a case and you call my office, I will tell you why I can't represent you. And I'll explain what I think you should do along the way. Of course, get a second opinion because I don't represent you. So I have no shortage of clients, and I don't expect that to end. And I'm happy about that.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jeff Devine from American Riviera Bank. All of our customers were once just like you, stuck with a bank that kept charging more for less. But when they finally made the decision to change banks, American Riviera Bank made the move easy with mobile deposit, online banking, free use of every ATM in the country, and a level of customer service that other banks dream of. Come in and make the move today in our downtown Santa Barbara or Montecito Upper Village branches. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people.
Are you ready to start and run your own successful business? Ready to grow your small business or home business? Women's Economic Ventures is a local nonprofit helping women start and build successful businesses. In addition to their highly successful self-employment training program, Weave offers services to help women succeed at every stage of their business, from startup and launch to building and sustaining a business, including individual business counseling, professional networking events, advanced business training, and small business loans to start or expand a business. Over 1,000 local businesses are now owned and operated by women who have taken part in programs and services. Whether you're ready to start up, launch, build, or sustain your business, Women's Economic Ventures is right here to help you make it happen. Call 965-6073 or visit weaveonline.org.
Community Alert, a positive preparation for disaster. It's designed to keep you informed about how to be prepared, not if, but when disaster strikes. Community Alert is heard Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. Community Alert, not if, but when disaster strikes.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we have David Seacrest, an employment attorney who is the owner of the law offices of David Seacrest, with us today. And so, Dave, how has this year been different for you, both positives and challenges with the pandemic raging in the employment world?
Well, I'm getting a lot of calls from folks who, you know, have lost their job simply because of the economic slowdown resulting from the COVID pandemic. And there's not much I can do for those folks. So that's been disappointing that I can't help everybody because obviously when a business shuts down, they're going to lay people off. And unless it's done in a you know, clearly a legal way, there's not much you can do for folks. So that's a sad part of my job. However, in terms of the nuts and bolts, it really hasn't changed because my practice is purely technology driven. I'm sitting here in my office right now, looking out at the 600 block of State Street, six blocks from the beach, with a Zoom conference with you guys on the radio. And everything I do, I mean, it's all technically magic, I guess, because I'm a caveman and I look at fire and it's just magic. I don't understand it, but everything is on my iPad, on a small disk drive, 30 years of work. I take depositions on Zoom from anywhere I am, anywhere I want to be. Most court appearances these days are by Zoom or court call. So I'm very lucky. My wife and I, who helps run my business partner and best friend, we don't have to be at any particular place anywhere to do the job of a litigation attorney. And we've been very lucky.
In some ways, it's actually been a positive for you, because as a plaintiff's attorney who works on contingency, travel, I'm sure, would add up in terms of an expense, you know, driving to court appearances. And now with Zoom, that's got to be a little bit easier, right?
Oh, you're right, Diane. It's not just a little bit easier, it's enormously easier. And I think that one of the results of this pandemic that we're going to see in the next year or two or 10 is an understanding that you do not have to travel to go to a court or a deposition or a lawyer's office to be just as every bit as effective. And in fact, it's far more effective, far better for the environment. And so my practice has not changed hardly at all. It's just become more streamlined and efficient.
Now, do you think after this pandemic has passed that the judicial system will, you know, keep some of these hearings remote as opposed to in person? Or do you think it will go back to pre-pandemic times where you would be driving around to various courthouses?
I think the practices that you're seeing now in the law, aside from the delays because of the pandemic in trial settings, which are extreme, I think that the way we're doing things now will be about 80% of what we see in the future. I think we're not going to go back to traveling for routine court appearances. There's just no need for it. It's not healthy. It's bad for the environment. It's expensive.
What percent of your business is settled out of court, and what percent is actually goes to trial?
Well, there's a couple of words you use there that I think require clarification, Neil. Going to court means filing a lawsuit and commencing the litigation process. Going to trial is far different. That's the last stage of a litigation process, the end stage. That's when you're in hospice. And the common percentages that you hear cited apply to my practice as well. Approximately 95% of cases that are filed go to court in that there is active and ongoing litigation, but do not go to trial because there are so many opportunities to resolve cases before trial. informal or voluntary mediation, just talks with defense counsel over the phone, or mandatory settlement conferences. 95% of cases that I have and that are litigated normally by anybody in litigation in California settle before trial. But there are times when you can't settle a case and you go to trial, and I've had a dozen, 15 or so jury trials up and down the state, and it's always very exciting. It's very stressful. It's expensive, but it's actually quite a thrill. I really dig it.
Now, are trials happening over Zoom or no?
There are some trials that are happening over Zoom, even jury trials. It's rare, but it's going to become more common. So if you can imagine a situation where you have 12 to 14 jurors in their homes on a Zoom panel, and they're watching the judge and the attorneys who are not in court. The judge may be in court with a court reporter, but no witnesses. And so, yeah, that's happening. We're being now offered an opportunity to skip the jury trial and go to a court trial, which is then automatically conducted and almost universally conducted on Zoom. And if you want both parties agree to that, you'll get a trial date much earlier. For example, I've got a couple of cases where I've said to the defense attorney, let's do a court trial. And of course, defense attorneys like to delay as long as possible so that they can avoid the risk of a trial, and they will not agree to court trials, and they are the ones now insisting on jury trials. So plaintiff's attorneys at least have them pay for the jury.
And do you find that because it's a small town, that when you deal, let's say, with Santa Barbara, you know all of the attorneys? So when the curtain is down, can you talk frankly and say, you know, what are we doing here? You know, this is how it's going to settle out anyway. I mean, can you have frank conversations and sort of avoid the cost and the time?
Yes, but I mean, they got to do their job and protect their clients. So they litigate the case and probe for weaknesses for months or years during the discovery process. But yeah, I have no problem picking up the phone and calling a defense attorney and saying, here's where I think things are going to turn out. And I think it'd probably be a good idea for your client and mine to resolve the case. The beauty about practicing in Santa Barbara is it's a small town, and the attorneys are quite polite and professional, and most of them are really, really good attorneys. And another reason I like to stay out of LA, because as soon as you cross the border and get down into Los Angeles, I mean, it's like a pit of vipers. I hate to say it, but it's just not quite the same. It's much more aggressive. And Santa Barbara is a walk in the park with lovely judicial officers and terrific attorneys. And it's awesome.
So, you know, how do you think COVID is going to change employment law going forward? And do you think businesses are going to be required to do something over and above in terms of a post-pandemic world, but in terms of mitigating risk for viruses, et cetera, sickness?
Well, you know, I think much of what will transpire is being determined today in negotiations in Congress. The Republicans in the Senate are insisting on absolute liability protection for any and all employers and businesses against suits from COVID infection. The Democrats are saying that's just giving them a blank check. It's going to be a little bit dicey, and there are no firm answers now. But there's two pathways I see forward. One is, I think employers just have to be as careful as possible. I highly recommend that employers speak with their defense counsel, their law firms that protect employers, by helping them generate sensible, legally compliant policies so that they make sure that they don't risk litigation and treat their employees properly. There's a lot of good law firms here in Santa Barbara and on the coast that will help you do that. There's also a website. I'll give you the website in a minute, but it's called the Society for Human Resources, and they have some wonderful policies online. It's called SHRM, and they have a whole list of policies and procedures that you can look to follow. That would be SHRM.org. I highly recommend that the folks who run businesses take a look at that, and they have wonderful free models and policies. And the third thing I'd recommend strongly is get EPLI insurance, Employment Practices Liability Insurance. Like any good business people, businesses should shift the risk when it's possible to do so. And if you have employment practices liability insurance, sure, it's going to cost a little bit of money, and you can check out, there's a couple of very good brokerages here in town that sell it. But that means when you get a lawsuit, you turn it over to them, pay your deductible, and you don't have to worry about it. So, you know, shift the risk, get EPLI insurance, go to shrm.org and check out their policies. But mostly just do the right thing for your employees and try to keep them safe to the extent you can do so without undue burden, and treat them fairly, not based on race, religion, you know, all the illegal stuff we can talk about if you want to, but just do the right thing.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
All right, class, let's hear what everyone did this weekend. Jill?
Well, I raised my older sister to a big oak tree. It was at least 100 years old. My mom said I must have set a record or something. And then we went down by a stream and perched up on this huge rock and saw all these little minnows swimming around way below us. And then I rescued my little brother from an evil slug king who was guarding him at the bush fortress. And my sister and I brought him back to our super twig fort for safety. And then we all laid out and told stories until it got dark. And the Big Dipper led us all the way home.
Wow. Awesome.
Where were you, Jill?
Yeah. We went to the forest. It's not that far away. Anyone want to come this weekend?
Ask your parents to take you and your friends to the forest this week and find the fun, adventurous you. It's closer than you think. Check out discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
The Friendship Center has something new to offer Santa Barbara area seniors. It's their Community Connect Adult Program, the first ever virtual membership program with Zoom classes designed to keep seniors connected and engaged. Here's Catherine Cherkis.
In addition to the Zoom classes, we do daily calls, write letters weekly. We do resource referrals, care consultations. We do take care totes where we send out food and supplies that someone would need for the entire month. And one of our coolest things that we do is a drive-in. We have the caregivers bring their loved ones in their car, and we do an hour-long activity. We lead them through a seated exercise. We do some jokes. No one works here for any other reason besides they believe in what we're doing and the importance of keeping seniors engaged and tackling isolation.
To learn more about the Friendship Center's Community Connect Adult Program, go to friendshipcentersb.org or call 805-969-0859.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about. So, David, let me ask you this. Me Too, the Me Too movement has been, you know, a seminal development over the last 5 years. How much of that has come into your office?
Well, I've got three or four cases I'm preparing for trial now. And I mean, almost every one of them, among a bunch of other cases that I have that are not yet set for trial. And it's an important legal doctrine. And in law, Me Too means that if there is, let me just give you an example. I've got a client, we have an age discrimination case set for trial in the spring. There were a number of comments made to him mocking him for being older and having colored hair or whatnot. A lot of comments about age. And then if we find out during that lawsuit, which we have, that there were also comments made by others, not to my client, or mistreatment based on age, and it could be anything, could be gender, disability, whatnot, then until recently, the courts would exclude that evidence because it wasn't something that was said or done to your client, the plaintiff in the case. But now courts have come around slowly but surely to realize, well, that could be relevant for a lot of things. It could be signs or evidence of a systemic discrimination based on age. It could be signs that the company didn't take its stated policy of non-discrimination seriously. It could be evidence that that made the work environment even more intolerable, because even though my client may not have been physically present during that mistreatment or discrimination or harassment, he heard about it, and it cowed him into not reporting it. And it goes to the relevance of an overall workplace hostility. So the Me Too movement in terms of employment discrimination means a lot more evidence can come in. It's a little bit more risk for employers, but I think in large part, the judges do a good time of sorting out what's relevant and what's not.
And when they decide what is that it can be brought in a jury trial, does that mean that you can bring witnesses up to talk about their experience with the employer in terms of discrimination?
Yes, yes. And the hard part that the judges have to figure out is how much of this evidence is directly relevant to the issues in the case. We don't want to have 7 or 8 mini trials. So I've seen a lot of judges say, yeah, I'll let you bring in 1 or 2 or 3 witnesses. And once a jury hears, okay, it's not just this guy or this woman who's been subjected to this treatment, it's the others. It's a pretty important piece of evidence that allows the jury to infer, well, then, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, basically.
But how do you deal with the time lapse? There is in the case, and I'm now no fan of Bill Cosby, but you know, he had people testifying against him that where the action happened 30 years ago. I mean, how do you defend yourself against something that happened that long ago?
Well, it's difficult, but let's take that into context, Neil. That was a criminal action, not a civil case seeking damages, and therefore the rules are going to be different. And the statute of limitations in that particular case, for example, rape or sexual abuse, some states have a dramatically expanded statutes of limitation. So you should know if you're defending, yourself in a case like Mr. Cosby was faced with, that a lot of this stuff is going to come in. It's going to be a long time ago. And yeah, you can deny it and you can present evidence against the person making the Me Too charge, but the jury's going to hear it.
And then it's up to the jury to decide whether or not that actually is relevant to the current case.
Well, the judge decides that it's relevant and therefore admissible. The jury decides whether it's going to cause them to rule a certain way, guilty or non-guilty in criminal law or for the plaintiff or for the defendant in civil law. But generally speaking, if you've got more than one person alleging the same pattern of conduct by a corporate defendant or employer, it's going to be not so great for the employer.
And so I'm trying to wrap my head around having a jury be all remote. So everyone's on their Zoom cameras during the entire trial, because I know when I've never personally sat on a jury. I've been called, but excluded. How can the judge ensure that they're actually listening?
You know what? That's a good question, Diane. And I don't know. I have not had a Zoom jury trial. I've spoken with a couple of lawyers that have. I think there's ways that they can do that by making sure that they're all on the monitor. Maybe the judge has an assistant to watch the faces. It brings into so many permutations of how that's going to change. For example, jury consultants who are usually at the trial looking at the live jurors to see their body language, to see how they're reacting or which ones to choose, they have to do that now by looking at a camera with 12 or 14 faces on it. It's got to be a little bit more difficult. So yeah, it's going to change a lot of things.
You know, it's harder to read people in a remote environment than in person, because you don't get to see all the body language.
That's true. That's true. It's difficult. For example, you probably can't notice that Neil is nodding off right now.
Sorry. I didn't hear that.
So I'm sure you're, as you had mentioned, you're being called for, wrongful termination, perhaps when companies roll up or downsize in these economic times that we're having. What do you see? Do you see a case that is going to happen to do with COVID as people are working remotely and perhaps they don't want to go back to the office and employers starting to make people come back to the office once we're through this? Do you see something like that coming down the pipe?
I see that's going to be very common. And then the question is, in my opinion, I haven't had this happen yet, but I assume it will. You'll look at it under the matrix of disability discrimination, wherein somebody's been afflicted with COVID. They have an underlying comorbidity. They've been advised to stay away from people. They get their doctor's note. They give that to the employer. And the employer decides, no, that's not going to happen. Well, then you look at it under the rubric or the matrix of an ordinary disability discrimination case, which basically boils down to the employer must accommodate, even with an extended leave of absence beyond the 12 weeks that are allowed under the FMLA, and allow further time away from work. And unless it constitutes an undue burden, they must provide an accommodation to that person. And we can go through what that entails. It's very complicated. But again, if you're an employer listening, you should get good legal advice, get EPLI insurance, and just try to do the right thing. The disability accommodation laws are very detailed. It's a labyrinth of requirements. And some people think that they're too intrusive and too restrictive. That may be, but it is law and you need to know what it is.
That's the state law, or is California, I would assume, is much more stringent than other states?
Somewhat much more stringent than other states. Well, in other states, in Texas and other states in the South, you can be terminated immediately without notice or cause simply because of your sexual orientation or because you get pregnant. California has a very protective environment for employees. It's under the Fair Employment and Housing Act. There's also the national standards under the Equal Employment Opportunities Act, which are somewhat less restrictive than California law, but they're still there. And to the extent you're in one of these other states that doesn't have very good laws for employees, you can rely on a federal scheme, but that puts you in federal court, and that's another problem altogether that some of us wish to avoid.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hi, I'm Jeff Devine from American Riviera Bank. All of our customers were once just like you, stuck with a bank that kept charging more for less. But when they finally made the decision to change banks, American Riviera Bank made the move easy with mobile deposit, online banking, free use of every ATM in the country, and a level of customer service that other banks dream of. Come in and make the move today in our downtown Santa Barbara or Montecito Upper Village branches. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people.
Come on, people. Think about it.
It's time to pay attention.
Mortgage industry is not rocket science.
Your guide to the information you can use to choose the best answers to your real estate financing questions.
Join me Tuesdays at 2 p.m., 10 p.m., and Sundays at noon.
Your guy in the mortgage industry, Guy Rivera.
Tune in to 1290 AM, Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We're 16 years on State and Islay. I'm Guy Rivera, your guy in the mortgage industry.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, David, on the break, we were talking about, you know, this, what some in the media are portraying as kind of a mass exodus of companies from California to, say, more corporate leaning or corporate favoring, I should say, than employee favoring domiciles, such as, you know, Tesla and Oracle moving to Texas. What is that going to do to their employees here? And what protections do these employees lose by their corporate headquarters moving to a state that favors the corporation over the employee?
The company gains nothing, because so long as the company has employees working in California, they are subject to California law. I even came across a case prosecuted by a colleague of some wage and hour violations on an oil rig offshore, which was deemed to be in California, and it was a Texas company, and California law was deemed to apply. So if you think you're going to avoid California employment restrictions, such as they are, by moving your corporate headquarters to another state, you're wrong. As long as you have employees in this state working here, they're subject to California law. Now, you might be able to remove the case from a state court docket and get it into federal court based on diversity of citizenship. But so long as the plaintiff's attorney can file a viable cause of action against one supervisor or manager who resides in California, then it stays in state court. So I know there's always been a lot of talk about employers leaving California because it's such a terrible business climate. And they always forget about the fact that it's the fifth largest economy in the world. And people apparently like to work here, and businesses apparently like to have business here because they make a lot of money.
Right. Of course. Well, and you know, there's always the political side of things. Who knows what's happening behind the scenes. But so in terms of when in this scenario that we're talking about, when the employee's supervisor that they're suing for whatever reason, employee in California, supervisor in Texas, is that then when it's deemed to be heard in federal court versus state?
In federal court, any case that's filed in California can be removed to federal court if the corporation is incorporated outside the state of California. And then you go to federal court. And it's a little bit more difficult for plaintiffs in federal court because you need a unanimous jury of 9. Federal court judges are appointed by life. They have enormous power. But generally speaking, if you can find one supervisor or manager who's engaged in harassment or whatever wrongful conduct you allege, you can keep it in California state court. I've written a couple of articles on this. The best causes of action would be a hostile work environment or harassment or intentional infliction of emotional distress. As long as you can state one viable claim, one claim that's quote unquote non-fanciful according to federal court law, then it stays in California courts. And that's the Wild West, according to a lot of corporations that practice out of state. They don't like it.
Do you ever get emotionally tied up with a client because you think the client was so aggrieved that you have more than a representational interest? You have an emotional interest.
Well, I bond with all of my clients, especially those that stick around long enough to have to take a case to trial. And I believe in the clients before I allow myself to be retained. So every case, Neil, to answer your question, there's an emotional bond. You have to keep things professional and make sure that you're doing the best job you can as an attorney, despite your emotional bond. But I mean, I think that helps me be a better attorney, to be honest, because I actually believe in what I'm doing. I can't take a case unless I know I can prove it. That means the client has to be credible, you know, attractive, believable, likable. And I look for cases where the employer has engaged in deliberate misconduct, unlike just a negligence claim. It's they've gone out of their way to violate the law and they know better. So I'm going to bond with those clients and I'll do the best job I can because I want them to be left with something.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. My feeling is you're too nice to be a litigator.
Well, you haven't seen me.
Panache of the whole thing.
You haven't seen me litigate, Neil.
Oh, that's true.
It was a great pleasure being with both of you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you. And thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Money Talk, and we'll see you all next week.
It's 3.